with thy pure and sincere friends. Let me be well-liked and respected on the earth and in the heavens. Let me be unruffled and well-composed in the midst of misfortunes. Let me be gratefully thankful in prosperity. Let me be mindful of much and more bounties. Let me ardently desire for the heart-warming meeting with Thee, well-equipped with piety to gain my end on the day of requital. Let me follow into the footsteps of Thy representatives. Let me disassociate myself from the mannerism of Thy enemies. Let me pass my time in this world by praising and glorifying Thee. كل صبح وكل اشراق ايام تبكى عيني بدمع مشتاق ايام قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبي ولها ولا راغي
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Rizvi.
How does the status of Mahbubiyat, to become the beloved of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, how did Ali reach to that point? Because in the path of spirituality, the most important thing is total submission to the will of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Total and absolute submission to the will of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Islam, what is Islam? The word Islam itself means to submit. And when a person reaches to the total submission, that is when he becomes the Mahbub of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. If you look at our namaz, you know, we should not just look at the ritual part of it. We should try to understand the spiritual dimension of namaz. The namaz itself, the way it has come to us, shows to us different levels of submission. We start the namaz with qiyam, we stand up. And then we go to the second stage, where we bend over with our hands on the knees. And then finally we go to the sajda. Qiyam is where we are standing up now to prepare ourselves, to submit ourselves to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Ruku is half submission. And then we go into total expression of humility and submission to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. If you pay attention even to the words selected for ruku and sajda, they are different. Because there are two different levels of submission. One is half and one is complete. In both zikr of ruku and sujood, we praise Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. The praise is same, but the wordings are different. In ruku, what do we say? Subhana Rabbi al-Azim. In sajda we say Subhana Rabbi al-A'la. Al-Azim means the great. In Arabic, and our friends and colleagues are here, Al-Azim is great. This is not the superlative form of that noun or adjective. Al-A'zam would mean the most great, or the greatest. Like Akbar, A'azam, A'lam. Among the mujtahideen we say, we should look for A'lam, the most learned. If we just say Alim or Alim, the learned. We do not say to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that I praise my Lord, the most great. We just say Al-Azim. But when we go to sajda, we don't say Subhana Rabbi al-A'ali. We use now the superlative form of the word. We say Subhana Rabbi al-A'la. Because when I was in ruku, this was just half submission. Now that I go to sajda, this is the expression of my total submission and humility to you. And therefore now I use this superlative term to describe Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala not as Al-Ali, but Al-A'la, the Most High and the Most Noble.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. Could the turmoil in Israel prove to be terminal for the Zionist entity? Only last month, former Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett warned that the settler colony was in greater danger than at any time since the Yom Kippur War. We'll be discussing the implications of these developments after this report by Latifa Abu Chakra about the role of the Israeli intelligence agencies in the current unrest.
Are Israeli intelligence agencies attempting to overthrow the Netanyahu regime? According to recently leaked documents from the Pentagon in the US, it would appear to be the case. The documents state that the US obtained this information via signals intelligence, meaning that the electronic communications of Mossad leaders are being monitored by the US. The information is labeled FISA, which means the spying received approval from a US federal judge, according to Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Just over a year ago, David Barnier, the head of Mossad, had his employment details and personal photographs leaked onto the internet following a hacking operation by an organization named Open Hands. How the mighty are falling. The Zionist regime is staggering and more cracks are appearing on a daily basis. It was previously reported that David Barnier generously granted permission to thousands of Mossad employees to take part in the anti-Netanyahu demonstrations gripping the Zionist entity, on the condition that they did not reveal their affiliations to other protesters. However, the US documents allege that the leadership of the intelligence agency is actively encouraging the unrest with several explicit calls to action against the government. This mobilization has entailed hundreds of military figures refusing to serve, from pilots to special force officers and even Israeli diplomats across the world going on strike and closing their embassies. It is not only the external intelligence agency that is conspiring to bring down the regime. The internal ones seem to be in on it too. Shin Bet, which supposedly answers directly to the Prime Minister, has been reported to have agents requesting permission to join the protests. Avi Ditcher, the former head of Shin Bet, has sharply criticized the Netanyahu government for harming social cohesion in the settler colony. Former chief of staff in the Israeli military, Moshe Yalon, has spoken at the rallies advocating for the overthrow of the regime. A desperate Netanyahu tried and failed to remove the current defense minister, Yoav Gallant, who is also working tirelessly against the government. Even Israeli intelligence think tanks like the Institute for National Security Studies are pushing against the government. Former military intelligence chief, Tamer Heyman, is director of the think tank and has stated that Netanyahu no longer has his trust. The Zionist dream is crumbling. We will return.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and is now a non-resident senior research fellow at the Center for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University. He's also a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch, and is a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. Our guest expert today is Asa Winstanley, who's been on the show before. Asa's an investigative journalist and associate editor with the Electronic Intifada. He also co-hosts the Electronic Intifada podcast and publishes a weekly Substack newsletter called Palestine is Still the Issue. And Asa's book, Weaponizing Antisemitism, How the Israel Lobby Brought Down Jeremy Corbyn, is now available to purchase. Welcome to the show. David, what do you make of these US documents regarding the protests in the Zionist entity then?
Well, first of all, of course, they said that these were not genuine documents, and then, of course, they came up with the story that this 21-year-old guy had access to all this material. It kind of looks like this is material which has been leaked deliberately by elements in the US security state. There's evidently a battle going on inside the US security state. Now, it's very interesting that they've leaked this material to indicate that they are spying on Mossad. Now, partly, presumably, this is done deliberately to indicate to Mossad publicly that that's what's happening, because, of course, there's an emerging split between elements of the US security state and the Mossad over the direction of Israel. And, of course, then what we're seeing now is that Mossad is actually on the other side, partly on the US side in the dispute with Netanyahu. So there are some cracks and fissures appearing in the Zionist regime, which is extremely interesting, given everything we've seen with the resistance recently and the strength of the resistance especially.
Mm. I mean, Asa, do you think the US are then engaged in a regime change operation? And if so, why?
It's possible. Israel has always been divided between its factions of Zionism. I mean, even before the State of Israel was founded, there's always been a kind of divide in the Zionist movement between the what's called the revisionist Zionist, the right wing, and the so-called Labour Zionists, who define themselves, or used to define themselves, as socialists. Their vision of socialism excluded the indigenous people of Palestine, you know, and it was them who really led the expulsion of the Palestinian people, who invaded the West Bank Gaza Strip and Egypt and Syria in 1967, and on and on and on, you know. We have this split, and it means that the historical dominance of the Labour Zionist faction of the security establishment within Israel means that despite the Netanyahu government, which represents the right-wing revisionist faction, and even now, Kahanist elements who are extreme, even more ultra-Zionist, you could say, despite that, what you could understand as the Israeli deep state is still very, very deeply dominated by this more sort of liberal Zionist faction. And so The no doubt the U.S. government is more in favour of that faction, and so it's extremely possible.
Mm. I mean, David, I mean, Mossad and possibly Shin Bet then, I mean, operating as fifth columnists against Netanyahu's regime, I mean, is that what's happening?
It appears to be. I mean, these files from the U.S. show it, but it had already been reported publicly that Mossad were allowing their members to go and join the demonstrations. And indeed, Shin Bet. Now, Shin Bet, of course, is the internal security agency, like MI5 in the UK or like the FBI in the US, and they've been doing the same thing. So there is an element in the security establishment, perhaps the dominant element, which is really opposed to the far-right Kahanist elements in the Netanyahu government. Of course, previously, we've reported on this show that Shin Bet have been condemning things like punishment attacks and price tag attacks, as they're called, revenge attacks on the Palestinians, and have denounced particular settler groups, including those associated with the Chabad sect, as being involved in something like 80% of the revenge attacks on Palestinians. So they have a history of telling a little bit of the truth about what the settlers are like. So no doubt there's a tendency there which is opposed to the radical, let's say, fascist elements of the Netanyahu government.
Mm. I mean, Asa, I mean, tell us as well, what's the significance of the Israeli Supreme Court?
So the Israeli Supreme Court is viewed by the liberal Zionists, the voters for the current Israeli opposition, as something of a check on the right wing's power. That they see it as this kind of great liberal institution, that its justice, its judges are not elected by politicians, and they see it as a sort of check. These kind of protests that they're having inside the Zionist entity at the moment, that is one of the main objectives, is to support the Supreme Court, the High Court. So it's something that they see as important to support in order to kind of have a a check on Netanyahu's power. But the reality of the Israeli High Court is that it is part and parcel of the settler colonial project. You know, it's got a long history of actually supporting the settler colonial project, of approving expulsions of Palestinian villages, of you know, legalizing settlements that are just planted in Palestinian communities and areas and villages. And you know, it was only last year in May that the Palestinian community of Musafa Yatta, for example, near Hebron, is under threat of complete demolition of an expulsion by the government, by the Israeli government. And the High Court of Justice approved that. Mm. You know, so this is the reality of the situation, that the two main factions of Zionism inside Israel, seeing themselves as sort of bitterly opposed to each other. They're only opposed to each other on strategic grounds. It's not on any kind of principled ground. When they say democracy, they mean only democracy for Jews and not democracy for the Palestinian people, who are really the majority in the land of Palestine between the river and the sea. You know, there's roughly, it's hard to know the exact figures because the Israeli government covers them up, but roughly 50% of the people between the river and the sea in historic Palestine, which includes present-day Israel, are Palestinians. So these protests inside Israel are not calling for democracy for them.
And David, I mean, tell us something about this INSS think tank and why its position on Netanyahu's of interest.
Well, it's a hawkish Zionist think tank. It has people on it from who've been very senior in the IDF and the Israel Occupation Forces, in the Mossad, and it's a hardline Zionist entity. But it has been very critical of this government and has been opposing it. So you see this whole sort of process of Zionism tearing itself apart. And if I can just say that maybe one way to see this is that the recent rocket attacks which occurred from Gaza, indeed from Syria, from Palestinian factions in Syria, the Golan, and indeed from Lebanon. Now, the response to that from Israel was to carry out bombing raids, but they didn't kill anyone. Mm. And of course, it was very widely seen that this was an attempt by the government to show that they were acting against the Palestinians, but they were deliberately trying not to kill anyone. And that's because the people who are in charge of this appreciate the calculus that they cannot set off the resistance because they would suffer severe consequences. And that's the division that there is inside the state, because the settlers and the neo-fascists and the fascists inside the government want to go in and wipe out the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. A second Nakba, they want to strike back at every possible opportunity at anyone who might in any way be regarded as being pro-Palestinian. But the government has not been doing that, and that's an indication of the bind they face themselves with. That they have to try and pretend that they're striking back, but they can't because the balance of forces is against them. So that's really the problem they find themselves with.
Yeah, and briefly, Asa, I mean, you've described this protest push in the Zionist entity as a mass racist movement. I mean, briefly, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, I wrote about it on my Substack. I called it racist mass movement because, as I mentioned before, they're not calling for equality. When they say that democracy, they're actually calling to preserve their colonial privileges within the Jewish state, that they want to actually preserve Israel and not to challenge in any way the inequalities that are inherent to it. Mm. And so really they are pushing for what the Palestinian academic Joseph Massad has called master race democracy.
Right. Well, we'll come back to the discussion in a moment after this report about the apparent role of the United States in fomenting the street protests in the settler colony.
In the midst of large protests sweeping the streets of the settler colony, the son of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Yair Netanyahu, took to social media to voice his opinion on who was behind this unrest. The American Department is behind the protest in Israel with the aim of overthrowing Netanyahu, apparently in order to conclude an agreement with the Iranians. Is there a Shin Bet in this country? He angrily tweeted. Following his unwelcome intervention, Yair was dutifully instructed by his father to stop tweeting. But was the petulant brat prince incorrect in his assertion? Well, it has been revealed that one of the main Zionist organizations behind this widespread unrest, the Movement for Quality Government in Israel, has actually been funded directly by the U.S. State Department over the last 3 years. Joe Biden, when asked about the proposed judicial reform in the protest in the temporary entity, stated that Benjamin Netanyahu would not be invited to the White House in the near future. The senile Biden commented with a grimace on the settler colony. They cannot continue down this road. He, Netanyahu ally and fascist Ben-Gvir, swiftly responded on the Israeli military radio, stating that the U.S. needs to understand that Israel is an independent country and no longer a star on the U.S. flag. Another figure in the Netanyahu administration, Zohar, the culture and sports minister, tweeted, "It's sad that Biden has fallen for all the fake news." Later, likely under pressure from the panicking Netanyahu, Zohar deleted the tweet. The U.S.-Israel relationship is more troubled than ever, and the contradictions are sharpening. We are watching.
David, tell us about this Movement for Quality Government in Israel organization that's being funded by the U.S. State Department.
Well, this is not the first time on this program we've found out that there have been State Department funds flowing to Palestine or to the temporary Zionist entity. Now, the other week we saw an example of the State Department, the National Endowment for Democracy, which is a CIA front group essentially, funding an investigative journalist attempt to look at an Israeli black ops company. And last week we said this was probably because they were trying to signal to the Israelis that they disapprove of some of their activities. Now here's more evidence of the same thing. The NED funding the kind of a colour revolution in Israel. I mean, who would have thought that such a thing could be possible? Yeah, even a month or two ago. But this is what's happening. The money is coming from the National Endowment for Democracy in to support these organisations. And indeed, as we've also reported in previous programmes, coming in to support organisations which are close to the Palestinian resistance.
Yeah.
And there's a fight over that as well, because of course the Israelis don't want that to happen, and the Americans are putting some money into the Palestinian resistance to try and influence that part of the Palestinian resistance. So we've got a very interesting situation in the context of declining global power for the US as we move into an era of multipolarity. Now, these kind of fissures in that context are extremely interesting because it means that there's all sorts of potential for there to be a further split between the Zionist entity and the US, which would be a good thing for everyone, I think.
Mm. I mean, and further to what David's just been saying there, then, I mean, Netanyahu has got a bit of a reputation for being a loose cannon, hasn't he? But, I mean, do you think there's an element of truth to what he's been saying?
Well, it sounds like it from these... I'm not familiar with this organisation, but, yeah, I mean, it sounds very much like a kind of colour revolution kind of situation. Netanyahu is interesting because he has tweeted before... He tweeted once a few years ago this meme that was quite actually virulently anti-Semitic, and we see this kind of tendency within Israel that, you know, Zionism is actually quite anti-Jewish because it's trying to push forward this idea that Jews don't belong in Europe, they don't belong in their countries, they belong as settlers in Palestine. And he tweeted out this meme which showed George Soros, I think it was, as a kind of puppet master controlling protests against his father at the time. So he's in control of Soros was like this caricature of a Jew, and in control of that was a lizard person. It was kind of crazy meme.
Yeah, wow.
But and he's on the same kind of path again. But despite all that, it does sound like there's a kind of small grain of truth underneath it that the U.S. is putting in this kind of regime change kind of operation.
Is it a small grain, do you think, or is it more than a small grain? I mean, would you put it no more than a small grain?
Well, I mean, look, there's no doubt that, I don't think you can mass engineer these kind of protests necessarily completely out of nothing. You can't just throw some money in and they'll just come from nowhere. It's kind of both. It's both, you know, these funds are kind of pushing these protests and encouraging them. And then the open signals from the US that they don't want this kind of more crude faction of Zionism, the Kahanists, to be overplaying their hand, because they see it as bad for Israel. They see it as bad for its PR, essentially.
Sure. Yeah. Well, David, I mean, what can we deduce then from Biden's statements on this issue?
Bad for Israel, as Asa says, but I think there's something bigger to say than that, which is that when Ben-Gvir says we're not any longer a star on the Stars and Stripes, what he's saying is that we are an independent nation, we are independent of the US, and we will have our own national interests. He's making a play to say that Israel is an imperialist state by itself.
Yeah.
And that is a red line that the US will not allow it to cross, because the US has to have it as a client. And if it's not a client, then it can be cut loose. Yeah. And that's the key thing, right? And so as we move into greater multipolarity, they're mulling this. Has its kind of attack dog got off the leash? And if it's got off the leash, they will have to cut it loose. And that will open up a huge new way of understanding and being in West Asia. And it will mean, I would think, it would hasten extremely the end of the temporary entity. I mean, Israel as a state cannot survive without U.S. patronage, and that's, you know, that's the difficulty for people like Netanyahu, who can probably see that, is that they've hitched their wagon to forces which will end Zionism and will end the Jewish state.
I mean, what do you make of this, Issa? I mean, Ben-Gvir's response to Biden was really quite interesting, wasn't it?
Yeah, and this represents quite an old opinion within the sort of ultra-Zionists, the Kahanist faction of Zionism. When I first went to Palestine in 2005, the very beginning of 2005, at the time there was the whole disengagement from the Gaza Strip when the settlers were being moved out of the Gaza Strip, and of course, America was supporting that process at the time, the rearrangement of settlers because of various reasons. But this thing about what Ben-Gvir said about not being a star on the American flag makes me think of a settler that I met at the time on the street. I was there with the Palestine Solidarity Group, the International Solidarity Movement, and one of the first sort of assignments they gave us was a solidarity protest with a Palestinian activist who was being, you know, he just was protesting on his land against the settlements and the building of the wall. And he was being forced to go to a court in Jerusalem, and we were there to support him. Well, coincidentally, there was all these settlers who came. They were part of the West Bank settler movement, and there was this whole orange movement at the time against the disengagement. They had all these T-shirts on. And some of my comrades were kind of arguing with them and sort of saying, why are you here? And they thought they were protesting against our Palestinian comrade, and they were getting into a discussion with them, and one of them said something similar to Ben-Gvir at the time and said, it doesn't matter what America thinks, we're our own state, we're not part of the American empire. I don't think she used the word empire, but what she was saying was very much along those lines. So they see themselves as independent despite the actual material reality, because they're extremely religious. They see themselves as God's chosen. And you can it's very easy to envisage a situation where a sort of more Kahanist-led Israeli government, which could be coming in the near future, would actually invade. You could see them invading even Jordan. It's not against the realms of possibility. We've seen some of these Kahanists talk about that. Yeah. That actually, the existence of Jordan is a historical compromise. Zippy Hotaveli, the Israeli ambassador to London, spoke about this decades ago. I wrote an article about it. I found an old video of a speech where she was saying that we can see in the near future. In the near future, we should have Syria and Jordan as part of us, as part of Israel, as part of the land of Israel. So, in those circumstances, you can very much, very quickly imagine the demise of Israel.
Thank you. Tune in to next week's show, where we'll be back with more investigations and analysis. So, until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
the bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Troubled First Republic stands on the brink as American banks' shares spiral to a record low after rescue options stall. Officials in U.S. scrambling to orchestrate a rescue by Wall Street's big banks. CNBC reported that bank was most likely to be heading for receivership. That could make it latest American lender to fall victim to banking crisis. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Reuters, U.S. officials are making urgent efforts to rescue the struggling First Republic Bank, as attempts by private sector companies have thus far failed, Reuters reported recently, citing some sources. People familiar with the matter told the outlet that the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC, Treasury Department, and Federal Reserve have arranged meetings with financial firms in recent days in an effort to hand the distressed lender a lifeline. Sources claim that the step could pave the way for more parties, including banks and private equity companies, to be involved. However, they added it was unclear if the government was considering participating in a private sector rescue of First Republic. They also highlighted that U.S. officials view a private sector deal as preferable rather than First Republic falling into FDIC receivership. "We are engaged in discussions with multiple parties about our strategic options while continuing to serve our clients," First Republic stated. A dramatic sell-off has wiped out 75% of the bank's stock value this week following the disclosure recently that it had lost more than $100 billion of deposits in the first quarter of the year. The San Francisco-based lender has struggled to stay afloat since the U.S. banking sector was hit by a major crisis stemming from the collapses of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank in March. Silicon Valley Bank, a significant player serving the tech and startup sectors, was shut down by regulators last month, shortly after California-based, crypto-focused Silvergate liquidated its bank. New York-based Signature Bank was also closed down by regulators due to liquidity concerns. To help First Republic avoid the same fate, leading U.S. financial institutions agreed last month on a $30 billion injection into the troubled regional lender. Efforts to inspire confidence in the banking system thus far appear to have failed, however. Shares of First Republic are down 97% this year. Earlier, RT had reported U.S. banking crisis fears mount as major lender struggles. First Republic says it plans to sell off assets, restructure its balance sheet, and lay off staff. Shares in First Republic Bank plunged another 30% recently following a wipeout, one day previously after the struggling U.S. lender revealed that depositors had withdrawn more than $100 billion in the first quarter. The bank's stock dropped 49% after the San Francisco-based lender disclosed that it had lost 40% of its deposits, fueling fears of further bank collapses in the U.S. The concerns followed the failures of Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank in March, leaving the U.S. banking sector facing its biggest crisis of confidence since 2007 to 2008 financial crash. Investors got a sharp reminder that the U.S. banking crisis and broader credit crunch are not over. The chief U.S. economist at Gallicol Research, Will Denier, commented, First Republic is considering strategic options to raise capital and avoid being seized by U.S. regulators, according to media reports. A source familiar with the matter told Yahoo Finance that a bailout plan would require assistance from the U.S. government. He said, there is an open bank path solution here, but it's a matter of the government needing to convene to bring all the parties together to make it happen. The recovery plan will reportedly include the sale of unprofitable assets and laying off up to a quarter of the lender's workforce of about 7,200 employees. However, media reports have highlighted questions surrounding First Republic's future as an independent lender or possibly as part of a bigger bank. Christopher Wolf, head of North American banks at Fitch Ratings, said any potential buyer of First Republic would be looking at a big write-down in the value of the lender's assets. Wolf told Reuters, the options are very challenging and probably very costly, especially for shareholders. Who is going to bear the cost? According to CNBC, advisors for the troubled lender will try to persuade some of the 11 banks that provided a $30 billion rescue package last month to buy First Republic's underwater bonds at above market rates for a loss of several billion dollars.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to yet another session of Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we try to answer your questions, queries that you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. Today, we have had the pleasure to be with Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member at Al Mustafa University. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
Well, Professor, when it comes to boys, boys are like, oh my God, they are the kings of their own worlds. They have their own rules. They don't want to listen to anyone. Now, how do we teach principles and laws to boys?
Yes, thank you very much for this question. Boys are very important parts of our lives. As we know, of course, the Holy Prophet said that boys are ni'mah and girls are rahmah. So we need to...
Boys are a blessing and girls blessings. Are a mercy.
Yes. So we need... Tomorrow we're going to be questioned about the blessings that Allah Almighty has given us.
Yeah, and boys are among them.
And so the boys are important. So we need to be able to develop a good relationship with them.
Yeah.
A very important... One of the most important things is to be able to make them principled. And for that, we need to be able to develop a special... loving relationship of, you know, of friendship.
Yeah.
And for that, as we said, we need to be talking to them heart to heart, looking at them when we're talking to them, making them feel important, making them feel confident about themselves, talking to them in a very polite manner, in a loving manner. All of these are important.
Yeah.
Then we need to make them, of course, these are general things, even for girls, but especially for boys, you need to feel that you are friends with them, especially fathers.
Yeah.
Or a son has a very loving relationship with his mother, but because of some of the distances which come into place between the father and the son, the difficult situations arise. So a father especially has to take this into consideration, that he develops a very friendly relationship with his son.
Yeah.
The son, even if the mother scolds him, he will not feel bad about it.
Yeah.
But if the father does that, he feels bad about it. So there has to be a friendly atmosphere from the beginning. A father should be playing with his son. He should feel that they are friends. He should always, the son should count upon him, upon his father as a friend, not as a guardian.
Yeah.
Then, of course, he should be able to provide a good example of being a parent, of being a father, and also of being a good son to his parents, to his father.
Yeah.
The way he sees, the son sees his father dealing with his father, that is an important thing.
You learn automatically.
Exactly. So he needs to be setting the example in his relationship.
So here again, as usual, we say that here the child will pick up things with your actions. He won't be dependent on your lectures or advices.
Right.
So we'll discuss more with you, Professor, after a short break. The listeners, stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We have had the pleasure to be with Professor Salman Akavi. And Professor is helping us to understand how do we deal with boys. Boys who are often very naughty, and Professor told us a few points. Before we go to the break, you said that we, especially fathers, got to be friends with them rather than being more like a guardian behavior, and so that they feel a little comfortable when they are dealing with their parents. Yes.
So we need to make them feel confident. We need to make them feel loving. The way I deal with my father, my son will also learn to do the same thing. And we need to make them act logically and reasonably, especially when I'm failing in something, then I should be able to make my child realize that, okay, failure comes, and with every failure, success is there.
Yeah.
Every success follows
failure. Failures are actually the pillars to success.
If you're not failing, then you're not succeeding. So we need to be able to inculcate in our children and our sons, especially because they're going to face the society tomorrow more than the girls.
Yeah.
So they need to be very logical in their dealings with others, with society, and being able to face failures. And both ways is important, how they cope with success and how they cope with failures.
Yeah.
Even success may lead to failures also. If one becomes too arrogant because of the success he has, apparently, he feels relaxed. If he becomes relaxed, the moment a person becomes relaxed, he tends to go down again and becomes a failure.
Yeah.
So when you're in a situation, when you're working hard and when you're trying to do something, achieve some goals in life, good business, successful business, you have always to be on your guard.
Yeah.
And you have to always be, apprehensive of anything, any problem that may arise. So you need to teach your child to be able to deal with difficult situations in a logical and reasonable manner.
Yeah, yeah.
Then we need to also, as I said before, it's not just the apparent behavior. We need to be able to teach them how to develop a good conscience. The conscience should be clear. Whatever they do, if they carry out good behavior, it is based on the conscience within them, the call of the fitra that is within them, that is calling them towards the goodness they are doing. The goodness should come from within.
Yeah.
Good behavior should come from within.
Yeah.
So we should teach our child, especially our sons, to be able to, follow the voice of their conscience.
Yeah.
And to explain to them that what they're doing, whatever goodness they're carrying out, the good behavior should come from there. It should not be just
a fake one.
Yes, it should not be something as an apparent, as you, for example, go to a salesperson and he will start speaking to you in a very nice manner. The real reason isn't that he's nice, he wants to sell his goods.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's talk more on that after a short break, dear listeners. Stay tuned.
Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam said, be inviters to people by means other than your tongue.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We have had the pleasure to be with Professor Salman Nakavi, and Professor is helping us with some very important information on boys. How do we deal with boys? Because boys are not always listening. They have their own world. They have their own choices. They have their own rules. But to make them disciplined and to make them the children, what Islam expects us to be doing as parents, Professor is helping us with some very beautiful notes. Yes, Professor.
We need to make our children, especially our sons, realize that they need to have high, noble goals in life. They should have dreams for their future. They should dream for success in their lives. They should achieve, the goals which Islam and our religion wants us to achieve, being more noble, lofty ideas. Make them realize that we are here for a bigger purpose, and we should make them realize that they need to go after those good, high, noble goals, and we should make them, we should boost them towards that goal. We shouldn't make them say, oh, these are just, dreams that you have. They cannot be realized. They cannot be achieved. No, You need to make them go for
Think
higher.
Think big, dream big, and act.
Exactly. So you need to make them feel very much energetic in their lives.
Yeah.
They need to be, of course, as I said, success along with failure, they should be able to cope with that.
If they are just failing in their lives, they should have this capacity to accept those failures.
Yes, I mean, they should target for high goals.
And use this failure as a ladder.
Exactly. I mean, they should go up to the to the top of the mountain. But in any case, when one is trying to struggle and struggling to go to achieve higher goals,
and if they are falling, they should not give up.
He may fall, but he should try again. He should try again, again, and again
until he reaches that peak.
Exactly. So, failure should not be something which makes creates
an
depression.
Obstacle in his life. Yeah.
And again, sportsmanship. We need to inculcate sportsmanship. We need to make them, not only sportsmanship, we need to make them good sportsmen also. Whether practically every boy should be a good sportsman also.
Which is good for their physical and mental health.
One of their physical activities should be sports.
Yeah.
And then not only that, the spirit of sportsmanship, which accepts defeat.
Accepts defeat, exactly.
Yes, that is also important. That is for boys especially because Their ego does not allow them to accept that. But a good sportsman is ready to accept defeat if he feels that the opponent is more...
And can't use that foul language always. He has to be taken care of, which is against the rules of the games and also against discipline. So you're saying that sportsmanship teaches a lot to boys.
Yes, so they should be practically playing games and sports, especially physical sports, not the games that are playing that are being played today in the virtual world. No, actual games should be played.
All right.
Especially boys should be taking care of their physique.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Professor. You have helped so many mothers today, so many fathers today, rather, who have boys and who are fed up of bringing them because they don't have enough choices. They don't know how to deal with them because boys are boys. Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you want to listen to our programs again, go back to our official website, which is www.parstoday.ir/en. Go to the tab COI Call of Islam and you will find an archive of our programs over there. In case you want to listen to our programs on the social media platforms, you can search Call of Islam Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.